This is The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Minchell. On today's show, we're talking Palestine and Israel, the gaps in our knowledge, the flaws in the so-called peace talks, and the reasons why many are calling for the creation of one nation state. This might seem a radical concept. It might even be a new idea for many of us. So we'll also be talking about the framing of the two-state solution by media and governments. Joining me are two people who've been guests on this program before. Anthony Lowenstein, independent journalist, blogger and commentator, was recently on the show speaking about his book Left Turn, a collection of essays on left politics in Australia. That program was one of our most popular, and fortunately for us, in these few weeks, his latest book has been published. After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine by Saki Books is edited by Lowenstein and Ahmed Moore. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
And also with us is Rahab Tarida, journalist, filmmaker and activist. You would have heard her speaking with us about the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, as well as the siege of Gaza and the 2010 Gaza Freedom Flotilla, so violently stopped by Israeli forces. Welcome back, Rahab.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with your book, Anthony. After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine is a dedicated exploration of the history and reasoning behind a one-state option. How did you approach this collection of essays? What were you hoping it would be, and how inherent to this was the idea of one nation state?
There's no doubt that most of the media coverage, political discussion for years is about a two-state solution. It's about a so-called peace process. It's about a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. And there's no doubt that many years ago, myself actually had a view of a belief in a two-state solution. In my Israel question, my first book, I talked about a two-state solution for a lot of reasons I won't go into in detail. I've changed, I've matured, I've evolved, having spent a lot more time over there. And the genesis of the book really was a few years ago, I was speaking to the two guys who run a website called Mondo Wise, which is a great American website that talks about this issue from a dissenting position. And the idea of doing a book about this, again, cut a long story short, and ended up working with a guy called Ahmed Moore, who wrote for that website. He's a Palestinian American, born in Gaza. So our backgrounds could not be more different. Never met him before in person, which is, I'm meeting him in a few weeks in Europe for the launch, which is a weird sort of modern way of doing a book project. And the idea behind the book was to have a range of writers, Jews, Palestinians, Arabs, atheists, etc., from the Middle East, from the US, from Europe, talking, not necessarily agreeing with each other, but saying the two-state so-called solution hasn't worked, is never going to work by definition for a range of practical and pragmatic reasons, but also ideological and ethical reasons. And a one-state solution, which essentially would mean a secular state in the territory that now covers Israel and Palestine, and people can live, Jews, Palestinians, Christians, whoever, safely. Now, clearly, I guess we'll get to this, there are obstacles to that. There's no question about that, and we talk about that, but none of the writers, some of whom are very well known, not everyone, you know, agrees with each other. There's disagreements. I disagree with some of the writers myself. But the idea was to put this idea in a more public sense, and it's moving in the last few years more from the fringes, more to the mainstream.
And how many of the authors that you feature in that book were already writing about this one-state option?
Some yes, some no. We obviously commissioned writers. All the essays in the book are new works, or they're adapted from other work that has been updated and changed for the book. And some of the writers are very prominent in this debate in the US and elsewhere in the Middle East. And I guess the idea was to put on the agenda not rather a discussion about should it be one state or two state, although those questions come up, but more importantly talking about the practical reality for the rights of the people under occupation, which of course is the Palestinians. I mean, ultimately, this debate, which is reminiscent of what happened in apartheid South Africa, it is different but it is similar on the level that the issues against the one state solution are remarkably similar to what was made 30 years ago. Namely, if we in South Africa have one state, the whites are all going to be killed and it's going to be chaos. Now, no one's suggesting that South Africa today is a utopia. There are profound problems in that country today. No question about that. There's almost an economic apartheid now rather than a physical apartheid. But the truth is that to put forward, as has been an agenda for at least two decades, a two-state solution, the writers in the book have thought about it, written about it, spent time in Israel and Palestine and the US, which of course in some ways is, if not the most important country in this debate, one of the most important places, that a belief that there needs to be an examination about how to make this happen rather than talking about if, a question of when and how to do it in a practical sense and analysing it from, you know, as everyone from Palestinians here to Orthodox Jews who believe in a one-state solution. So to put on the agenda for a public audience who maybe haven't heard much about this, It's happening. It's going to come at some point, I would argue. We argue inevitably. Let's make it a just solution sooner rather than later.
And how wide is that? Is that sort of support for this idea? How much of a push is there for this one-state alternative to the two states that is seemingly being broken in the peace negotiations?
If you ask the majority of Jews in the Jewish establishment, you'll find about four supporters, of which I am one. It's not massive. There's no question. In the Jewish establishment community, in the Zionist lobby community, there's a profound fear of a one-state solution, because the practical reality, for those who don't understand, is that Jews would be a minority in that state. Palestinians would be the majority. So there's a fear, I would argue often unjustified fear, but there is a historical fear, insecurity, call it whatever you want, that Jews would be massacred en masse, there'd be, you know, a Holocaust-type situation. That rhetoric might sound extreme, but you hear that routinely in the Jewish establishment. In the Palestinian diaspora, I would say, and Rehab can answer this better than me, I'd say there's probably a majority view this would be the best solution. There are some who support a two-state solution, to be sure. And in Palestine itself, in Israel itself, there are minority of Jews, to be sure. In Palestine itself, the figures in the last few years, most polling, and polling is not that accurate in Palestine, but polling certainly is increasingly popular to believe in it, mainly because a two-state solution, even if it was just, which it certainly is not, has brought nothing after 20 years of so-called negotiations apart from colonization, and now close to 600,000, if not more, Jewish settlers illegally on Palestinian land. So the idea of partition is simply not feasible in any way, or ethically for that matter either.
I know you mentioned very briefly your personal change on this issue, but I was wondering if I could just get from both of you really quickly when you first started thinking about this one state idea as opposed to the general sort of talk of two states. Rahab?
Well, I think that I've followed the issue, I guess, for the bigger part of my life, being Palestinian. And the two-state solution was never, it's an oxymoron to call it a two-state solution. It doesn't solve any of the persistent problems that Palestinians face. And I guess, in a nutshell, it sort of presents the whole situation as though there's two equal claims to the land. And so the problems, if you like, that have persisted over, you know, one decade after the other, they're not, dealt with in the so-called two-state solution. Namely, that Israel has been built on and has been maintained, you know, on Palestinian land and at the expense of the Palestinian people. So the two-state solution doesn't even, you know, touch on any of that. I mean, seven in 10 Palestinians around the world live in forced exile, so that would be maintained. So the status quo, if you like, would be maintained if a two-state solution was to be established. So it doesn't really deal with the root causes of the problem, which, you know, if they're not going to be dealt with, then the problems between Palestinians and Israelis will persist.
In terms of my genesis, I suppose in brief, it was spending a lot more time with people on the ground there, both Palestinians and also a number of dissident Jews. Many of whom in Israel increasingly do support a one-state solution, or certainly don't support a two-state solution. Spending a lot of time actually in the settlements themselves, not as a supporter, but certainly as an observer, and seeing that there has been, I think, in the last, say, 5 or so years, I think a realization, and this, I suppose, is part of my journey as well, to say that two things. One, as Rehar rightly says, that a two-state solution does no way to actually address historical issues that exist from day one, from 1948. And secondly, to say that as many people who are liberal Zionists, those who are certainly critical of the occupation sometimes, but also believe that the issue started in 67, which is when there was a Six-Day War and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza began. So here we are 45 years on from that, and there are now 600,000 Jewish settlers illegally occupying that land. I think what's becoming clear, and this is partly, I suppose, my own realization, is even if there was a belief that Israel wanted a just partition, and they frankly don't, the evidence is that there was a recent Israeli government report said that the occupation wasn't an occupation at all. It was a Levy report, as a former Supreme Court judge, who said the occupation was just, you know, land was legally colonised by Jewish settlers. So I think it was partly a practical realisation for me, but also an ethical one, spending a lot of time with Palestinians, a range of whom, both in Australia and overseas, who were talking about this idea, which initially sounds maybe radical, but in fact in practice is not. The obstacles, as I guess we'll say, they're there. No one's saying it's going to be utopia now or then. But the reality now is that we've got to a situation where a one-state solution seems like actually a very sensible outcome and a just one.
And I think so, just to add to that, I think that the issue you raised earlier, that putting ideology aside, I mean, on a practical level, Israel has rendered a two-state solution impossible.
Indeed.
Since the West Bank was occupied, more settlements have been built, closed military zones that are designed to protect the settlements are built around them. You've got checkpoints all over the West Bank. What these actually do is fragment the West Bank geographically. So you've got this cluster of Bantustans. So the area within the West Bank is not territorially contiguous. Israel has rendered the West Bank into Swiss cheese. Like it's not even a viable solution anymore. So, you know, politics aside, ideology aside, it's physically not possible to create a state on what is left of the West Bank.
And I think also just to close on that is that I think a lot of people maybe who haven't visited there don't realise the extent of that colonisation. That when you spend time there in the West Bank, in Palestinian villages, or for that matter in Jewish settlements, you see that Israel has remarkably successfully, from its own perspective, colonised land in such a way that when you have, for example, the IDF, which is the Israeli Defence Force, whose primary role is to protect settlements from, you know, supposed resistance from Palestinians or security-wise from outside forces, you realise there has been a very effective way of sealing over any kind of chance of a two-state solution.
In After Zionism, one of the early essays by Ilan Papp outlines the Israeli denial of the early violence and its absence in our history books and in media coverage of the current situation. How much of this early or basic history and premises of the conflict are often gaps in public knowledge, and which of these are essential in understanding the conflict? Do we need to go all the way back to this Nakba history and this violence?
Well, I think that because there hasn't been any formal recognition, I think that the issue will always persist, especially because the injustices caused by the initial invasion and destruction of Palestinian villages and towns in 1948, those injustices are still with us today. The majority of those people and their descendants live in refugee camps that are unlivable, really, in Lebanon and Syria and the surrounding Arab countries. So I think it's important to go back because it's still with us today. It's not something that's just in the past and happened so long ago. But I think also that, colonialism comes equipped with not only weapons, but also myths. And we don't have to look as far as Palestine. This land, this Aboriginal land that we're conducting this, you know, discussion on is, there's so much mythology and false history that's presented to us as though this country was settled in a quite, you know, in a happy and, we don't need to look that far to see that there is always going to be political denial about, the indigenous people's history, their own history on the land that's been colonised. And in Palestine, I think that Israel is basically has denied that the Nakba ever happened. It basically presents the Nakba to us in such a way that, you know, Palestinians left because they were asked to by, you know, Arab leaders through the radio. There's all sorts of, you know, crazy ideas that are put forward. But I think that, you know, I mean, in some European countries, Israel has pushed for Holocaust denial to be illegal. You know, they've criminalised Holocaust denial, which is great, you know, in some European countries. At the same time, though, when within Israel, you know, there's this denial that the Nakba ever happened. We're talking about over 100 massacres and destruction of over 400 towns and villages. I don't think it's something that, you know, I think any solution to this problem needs to take into account, you know, basically what's happened during the Nakba and after and how that's affected Palestinians as well as Israelis.
I think it's also interesting as a colonial country, and Israel clearly is that, as Australia is, as New Zealand was, Canada, America, etc. As Rihar rightly says, the way that these myths are perpetuated until the present day, I mean, you could argue, I was in high school not that long ago, 15 odd years ago, I don't recall ever learning about Aboriginal history at all. Now, I didn't see my school as being particularly overtly racist. I mean, in some ways, I could say implied it is racist not to learn about that, and it is in a way. Clearly it is. But in Israel today, the education system for Jewish students, which is, of course, is the majority of students in Israel proper, deliberately, and there are articles about this constantly in Israeli press, are deliberately excluding what happened in 48, framing it as a liberation post the Holocaust, when Jews were looking for a homeland and there was nothing there, and they built it literally out of nothing. And there's no doubt there were some Jews after the Holocaust who were looking for somewhere to go. That's an obvious historical fact. But the reality was it was on the back of somebody else who was living there for a long time. And I think until, as Rehab says, there's an acknowledgement of that and understanding about that, you can't reverse history. What's happened has happened. But what you can do is acknowledge compensation, but also a right of return, which we talk about in the book, which just briefly means that the Palestinian refugees who were expelled in 48, 67 or since have the right to return. Some will, many won't. That's obviously up to them to make that decision for every family and individual, but they have the right to do so. And of course, if that happened tomorrow, which it wouldn't, the majority of people would, of course, be Palestinian or Muslim or Christian, and they would not be Jewish. And that, to me, is a just outcome.
And I guess, so just to add to that, I mean, when you have a society that is based on the exclusive rights and privileges for one group within that society, which, you know, Israel is basically an exclusively Jewish state, so it's basically privileges Jews over other religious and minority groups. So when you have a society that's based on that kind of privilege at the expense of another people, it's no doubt that equality, the notion of equality, would be scary for a people whose privileges have been based on the suffering of other people. So, I mean, I guess the highest Palestinian demand has been equality. One person, one vote. Right of return for Palestinian refugees and their descendants. And, you know, to basically have equal rights. But that notion, because Israel is based on privileging one group of people over the rest of the people that live there, I guess that's why it's seen as radical and not accepted, you know, to the degree that we're seeing, I guess.
And some of the essays in the book make the link between the lack of official acknowledgement of Nakba events and how that is linked with the right of return, and how both of those issues have not been a part of peace negotiations. I was wondering if you could very quickly talk about, yes, the last little period of negotiations and what that has meant for both Palestinians and for Israel as well.
In short, and of course, there's been 20 years of so-called peace negotiations since Oslo. The people may remember there was a famous White House lawn ceremony in 1993 where the Israeli, Palestinian and American leadership all shook hands, and there was going to be peace and, you know, group hugs the next day. The reality is what's happened over that period, which is arguably what Israel and America wanted, and indeed the Palestinian leadership, which has been complicit in this, has been the illusion of a peace process while colonization continues apace. So in the so-called peace process period, settlements have more than doubled in size. In fact, they've more than doubled now, but in the 90s, during a so-called peace process. And I think it's important that people who are listening to this, when they constantly hear in the media, Bob Carr, for example, just recently was in Israel, talking about, as a foreign minister of Australia, talking about the idea of a peace process, if only people got back to the table and negotiated. The negotiation process is deliberately designed from day one to exclude Palestinian rights. So unless we actually believe, as we should in the book argues very strongly, in the idea that the whole framing around negotiation changes, the illusion of peace negotiations is simply allowing Israel, which it's done very successfully, to colonise land for the last at least 20 years, if in fact many more than 20 years.
You're listening to The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Mintrell, and we're exploring the very real option of a one-nation state for Israel and Palestine with Anthony Lowenstein, editor of the recently published After Zionism, and Rahab Trida, Palestinian journalist and filmmaker. We were just talking peace processes, and one other aspect in the book is the lack of freedom of movement that has actually come into place after the start of those Oslo talks. What are the other concepts that you think are really important for people to understand?
Well, I guess Israel has created a situation on the ground where it has complete, total control of people's lives. So every aspect of people's lives under occupation is affected by the occupation. So getting to school, very normal day-to-day things, getting to school, visiting a friend in the next town. I mean, when I was there, and Anthony probably experienced this himself, you know, if you're planning to go from Ramallah to Jenin, which would normally be a 45-minute drive, you've got to plan for days and think about how many checkpoints along the way. That's the permanent checkpoints. Then you've got flying checkpoints, which can randomly, basically jeeps that parked
Israeli army jeeps. Yeah,
yeah, that stop on any at any point on any road, and so it's difficult for people to go by their day to day lives. I mean, you don't drive for more than 10 minutes without having your car checked, and I don't know if people here can imagine that. Like, you drive from, you know, from here, Ultimo to Marrickville, and you go through 3 or 4 checkpoints. So people's lives, I mean, it's very hard to, I mean, any semblance of a normal life has been shattered by the occupation. And the negotiations, like Anthony said, I mean, when you said it's been 20 years, I thought, wow, it has been 20 years.
More than 20 years, actually.
You know, such a long time. And actually, Mustafa Barghouti has a great analogy talking about the peace process. He said that, you know, it's like imagining, you know, Israel, the Israelis and Palestinians are negotiating over a cake, but while they're discussing it, Israel's eating the cake. And that's exactly what's happening. So they're talking about negotiating, you know, in inverted commas, you know, this bit of land and who's going to take control and what that would look like. But while that discussion is being had, more settlements are being built. The apartheid wall has since been built and snakes through, not around, doesn't surround, doesn't border the West Bank, goes snakes into the West Bank, takes out the best chunks of agricultural land, separates Palestinian towns from each other. That's the situation on the ground in the West Bank. In the Gaza Strip, you've got the siege. It's isolated from all, you know, of its borders with Egypt and Palestine 48. And, you know, movement within and without and of goods and people is completely restricted. So there's no such thing. I mean, the Palestinian economy has just been completely destroyed, and Palestinians have not been able to independently grow as a people, and, you know, so it's affected the economy and people's lives in a number of ways.
And how much of the politics of what's been happening within these negotiations essential to sort of understanding how to even challenge the way the issue has been framed, and this issue as well, that the occupied are responsible for the security of the occupiers? So Diana Butti's essay outlines how she sees that the Oslo agreements effectively transformed the Palestinian Authority into Israel's security subcontractor. And I guess that's just one of many aspects.
It's something that I think a lot of people are probably unaware of, that you have a situation in Palestine which is sadly not that dissimilar to a lot of other colonial environments, where the occupier is essentially very cleverly, from its own perspective, paying, arming, funding, training the colonised to monitor its own and manage its own occupation. So you have throughout the West Bank a number of Palestinian authorities, who is the supposedly legitimate government, although the leadership actually was voted in years ago and actually haven't had elections. So they're there illegally anyway. Putting that issue aside for a moment, which is not an unimportant issue, they essentially are cracking down on dissent against their own regime and against Hamas and against Israel. So it's not surprising that many Palestinians in the West Bank rightly feel pissed off with the fact that if they, for example, want to protest about corruption in their own authority, that they are crushed and repressed and tortured by their own state apparatus, which is funded, armed, trained by Israel. And we shouldn't also forget as quickly that the Palestinian Authority exists under the illusion that it's allowed to be funded and armed by and trained and by Australia and the EU and most international community. So when Bob Carr, for example, goes to Palestine and talks about how much money we're giving to the PA, I don't doubt some of that money goes to good things. I'm sure some of it does. But the vast bulk of that money is going to maintain an illusion of some kind of state-building apparatus. When, if all international money disappeared tomorrow, and the World Bank says there's hardly a crazy left-wing organisation, that the Palestinian economy is fundamentally financed through international aid. So you can't build a state based on EU funding or Australian funding or US funding. So this is really a fundamental issue.
How much a part of this push towards a one-state alternative is about shifting towards requesting non-negotiable rights, which are the basic human rights, as opposed to what has been seen as negotiable rights, which is that over territory?
I think eventually a one-state solution. I don't think that Israel is going to, you know, say, oh, look, we've been treating the Palestinians quite badly, we've stolen their land, we've stripped them of their rights, we need to reverse that. I don't think that's going to happen today, tomorrow, or in 5 years. But I think that the situation on the ground is going to change so much, not just in Palestine, but in the region, that Israel is going to be forced to, I guess, the only solution that will be left is a one-state solution at the end of the day. And it will be a while before we get there. But eventually, I mean, the reality on the ground in Palestine has changed. And I think that as Palestinians, we have to consider that when thinking about the way forward and what the new state, if you like, would look like. But it certainly has to be based on equal rights for all. And, you know, it is still essentially an issue about land and land rights. You know, Palestinians have had their land stolen from them, and that hasn't been, they haven't been compensated, haven't been allowed to return. And that's definitely, I guess, a big factor and a big part of the solution, well, needs to be part of the solution. But I don't think it will be as simple as Palestinians will return to the land that was stolen from them. I mean, there needs to be reimagining, if you like, of what the future state would look like. If Jewish people feel, and I guess I speak for lots of Palestinians when I say this, if Jewish people feel that that land is sacred to them and that means something to them, that's great. They're more than welcome to be there and to live there. This is, I mean, I guess my attitude anyway, but it's the colonial nature of Israel which suffocates Palestinian daily life. That's the issue and that's the problem. And that needs to be, I guess, and it will be eventually, Israel will be forced to have to. It can't be maintained. I mean, trying to maintain a privileged minority over the land of an indigenous majority, as we've seen in South Africa, it's impossible to maintain it. So eventually, I think we're going to get there, but it'll still be a little while yet.
Mm. And do you see that Mahmoud Abbas taking the bid for statehood to the UN last year as an attempt to bring this into sort of an international legal framework as opposed to the structure that had existed within the peace negotiations for so long?
This is a very interesting question. The book talks about some of this. Actually, the Palestinians are talking about going back to the UN, I think next month to try it again. I mean, there's no one consensus view about this. I mean, many Palestinians in the diaspora and me personally think that Mahmoud Abbas and the PA have been a fundamental disaster for Palestinians. But the view about whether going to the UN to try to change the equation is a fundamental mistake, I'm ambivalent about that. I mean, ultimately, it's not really my decision. Initially, of course, there's questions about, are you trying to codify a two-state solution? What's the actual aim of this? What are you trying to achieve? I mean, one side of it is that the Palestinian leadership, for want of a better expression, are trying to change the framing of what is going on over there rather than going back to futile negotiations. But I'm not sure Rehab might have a different view, but I think that my sense is that there is a mixed opinion within the Palestinian communities itself.
I think, firstly, it's really important to contextualise that. And Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority, is the product of Israel and US. You know, it's basically the product of the Oslo Accords, which was a US and Israeli-led initiative. And since it was created, it has served Israeli interests and US interests on the ground. I mean, it doesn't take too much analysis to see that. But I think also the other issue is the whole issue of statehood, and although I support a one-state solution, I think the issue, like framing it as though it's about statehood, takes away from the real issues here. And I mean, a friend of mine actually was interviewed recently, and he was asked, you know, do you support a one-state or two-state solution? He said, I don't care if it's one state, 10 states, 50 states. The issues of injustice have to be dealt with. And if that requires 10 states, if that requires 20 states, of course, only a one-state solution, given, you know, what is happening on the ground, given, you know, the injustices that have, you know, have continued, I think only a one-state solution would, you know, to help to solve those and help us to move forward to a kind of different reality. But having said that, it's not the issue of state building, I think sometimes, you know, takes us away from the real issues at hand, which are the injustices that are being inflicted. You've mentioned some, we talked about some of them before, but also, you know, the right of return, things like that. It's more about those issues than it is about creating a state.
And with that, we must wrap up. You've been listening to Rehab Tarida, Palestinian journalist and filmmaker, and Anthony Lowenstein, independent journalist and commentator. We've been discussing a very possible one-state option for both Israel and Palestine, and clearly we've only touched the surface. We're limited by time here, but you should really find yourself a copy of the recently published After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine, co-edited by Lowenstein and Ahmed Moore, and published by Saki Books. It's available
at all good bookshops and online.
Thank you both for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
I'm
Jessica Minchell, and this is The Third Degree.